Bien. Bonjour pour cette séance de l'après-midi et bienvenue. Welcome for this afternoon session. We start almost in time, and the first speaker is Christian Gollier. We'll present a joint paper with Jean Tirole, both are the Toulouse School of Economics, and the title of the paper is Effective Institutions Against Climate Change. Christian.
Thank you, Roger. When I was invited to this conference, I didn't know what to present. I think 1 month before the COP21 in Paris, it's probably more important to try to make an informal presentation of the main policy questions that remain open, rather than going to presenting a detailed paper on, you know, my field of specialty, which is the discount rate. You have here this new issue of opinion débat of the LabEx Louis Bachelier. If you want to read this, so that's the reference for my presentation. Everything I will say is in there. I suggest that you read the English version. There is a French version that has been translated. I check it. Jean, check it, but they are probably not always. I mean, the English version better present our ideas. Okay, so. So what I want to do is to present what Jean and I consider what should be done if we want to build efficient institution in order to put the planet in the right way to solve the climate change problem. Well, of course, it's an incredibly difficult question. Climate change is probably the most challenging problem faced by humanity. Since its beginning, and for many different reasons. The most important one is that it's a externality. So most benefits of mitigation are global, they are distant, and they are uncertain. Well, that means in particular that if you look for France, for example, France will bear 100% of the cost associated to its effort to reduce its emission. But then probably get only 1% of the benefits of this effort. So it's an externality, okay? And the consequence of that is that nobody gets the right incentive to make what would be socially desirable to do. Moreover, even if we imagine a country that would like to do the good for humanity, bearing the cost, not getting most of the benefit, will be difficult in the context of climate change because of what we call the carbon leakage. Can the carbon leakage mean that, you know, if, for example, France would decide alone to put in place an ambitious plan to reduce emission, that will reduce the competitiveness of its industry, and therefore that will imply that there will be delocalization of employment, of wealth creation, and probably the net effect will be zero. And so the effort of France will not be for the benefit of the climate, but rather it will be for the benefits of those other countries who would not make the effort. So that's the second reason why climate change is a particularly complex and challenging problem. Moreover, we need to think that climate change comes from burning oil and gas and coal. And those current owners of those resources will probably react to any action that will induce us to reduce the consumption of those goods. They will probably reduce their price. Okay? At the end of the day, if we don't get some coordination at the level of the planet, it's likely that this cheap source of energy, oil, is much cheaper than any other source of energy, that will be burned by someone, somewhere. Okay? And so we really need a collective, a big coalition in order to fight those different challenges that could lead to an efficient solution. And moreover, the climate change problem is linked to inequalities, worldwide inequalities. Okay, many people, in particular developing countries, want to link the problem of fighting climate change with the problem of reducing inequalities. And that adds an additional degree of complexity into the problem, in particular because we don't have any clear definition of what is fairness, what is inequalities, what is, in this context of climate change, what is the definition of common but differentiated responsibilities. Okay, so but, however, so you know, economists are, economics is often referred to as the dismal science, okay? And probably the first slide was a confirmation of that. However, you know, the good news is that if we would be able to implement an ambitious plan to reduce emissions, everybody will win from that, okay? Everybody on this planet, we could find a solution where everybody would get a net benefit from exerting effort to reduce emission. Okay, the difficulty is that how to coordinate people to get to this result. Okay, if you think about that, there is a lot of thing to win on this. If you believe, for example, that as many people would. Relatively large degree of error. If we believe that each ton of CO2 generates damage, a future damage whose net present value is around $30 per ton of CO2, remember, we emit something like 50 gigatons of CO2 every year. So 50 gigatons at $30 per ton means 1.5 trillion of damages that we generate every year on this planet by emitting CO2. So that's a big thing. It's also, if you perceive that from the opposite direction, it's also, if we are able to impose this price of $30 per ton of CO2, it's also a creation of a big carbon rent that we should share among different countries, among different people. So that could take the form, for example, of a carbon tax. So we could decide in Paris, that will never happen, but if that would be possible, we could collect every year $1.5 trillion tax in order to fight climate change, and that will be used for many different things. So, the difficulty, as I said earlier, is can we overcome the tragedy of commons, the fact that it's an externality and every individual on this planet is not incentivized to reduce his emission because he bears 100% of the cost and a small fraction of the benefits. So at equilibrium, in the business as usual, nobody do any effort, although this red sentence is there. Collectively, we would all win by doing something. So that's the basic externality problem. It's particularly difficult for the reason I mentioned on the previous slide. And what we have experienced over the last three decades is quite awful. It has been a painful experience to observe that since the early 90s, since the time we know that emitting CO2 generates damages and can put humankind on risk on this planet, nothing has been done, basically nothing. Okay, from Kyoto 1997 to Copenhagen, there has been a striking contrast between the long-term commitment to reduce emissions by the year 2050, for example, and almost nothing in terms of short-term commitment. And the reason is very simple. That's the problem of the externality, the free riding problem. And we have, Jean and I think many people in this room, have limited confidence in the promises that are going to be made in Paris next month. One illustration of that, one easy check for the low credibility of those commitments is check whether countries are ready to really commit on things and get accepted an international organization that would verify those commitments, the fulfillment of those commitments, and get people in countries punished if their commitments are not done. If countries are credible in their commitment, they would be agree and they would gain from accepting to have a verification system. and a penalty system in order to be sure that the other do this, that what they promised. So the fact that we don't see that, and if you look at the few pages, the 50 pages of the project of proposal for draft of an agreement, you see everywhere that almost all countries are against any system in which their pledge would be replaced by commitment and penalty if those commitments are not fulfilled. So little credibility. So the lessons of this experience over the last 30 years is that we need something. We need something to fight the deep free riding problem that is linked to externalities and public goods. We need carrot and stick approach to the problem. And that was not there in Kyoto. So we need to add something like that. I will come back on that later. So also, we have been over the last three decades in what we call a waiting game. The fact that countries wait year after year to get another round of negotiation to postpone their promise to reduce emission. Okay, the consequence of that is that in the meantime, there is too much emission, and that is exacerbated by carbon leakage, as I presented in my first slide. Worse, the anticipation of future negotiation provide negative incentive for each player. Okay? If you know that you will be better treated at the next negotiation round if you don't do much effort this time. Okay, and there are plenty of examples that demonstrate that. People who emit a lot will get extra permits, for example. Okay, so reducing effort provide a better bargaining power for the next round of the negotiation. And so this system of periodical renegotiation of an international agreement is even worse than the business as usual. Okay, so as you know, since Copenhagen, we decided to abandon the use of any economic instruments in the international negotiation. Okay, so it's somewhat striking to this morning to see this paper presentation where we assume that we are going to use economic instruments to solve the problem. But today, we are not at all in that dynamics. We are in a dynamics of pledge and review, okay, INDC, intended nationally determined contribution, with no commitment, no verification, almost nothing. Okay, we just have to believe that countries that make those announcements will do what they announce. Okay, so when you look at this paper that came out of from the bond negotiation last week, this draft proposal for the agreement, there is almost nothing there on measurement, reporting, and verification, enforcement. Okay, everywhere when we look at enforcement in that document, we see that everywhere it's written that the process of verification will be quote unquote non-punitive. So. And that's very strong. Okay, so that's another demonstration that most countries in this planet are not willing to commit on anything. They are ready to pledge, but not to commit. Okay, the consequence of that, when you look at all those pledges, it's very diverse. And as we know, it's a command and control. There is no chance that this dynamic, absolutely uncoordinated, will lead to anything close to what is socially desirable, and that was presented this morning. Economists know that in order to minimize the total cost associated to an abatement related to a specific objective of increasing the temperature by no more than 2 degrees Celsius, we need to equalize marginal abatement cost. Okay? And there is no reason to believe that what the current process will lead to that. Quite the opposite. We know that in that kind of system, some effort will be made that will be extremely costly in terms of ton of CO2 escaped, whereas other projects that would reduce the emission a lot and are absolutely free will not be implemented. So that's very inefficient. Well, There is some hope, however. Countries are ready to do something. Okay? But this something is what we call zero ambition promises, to quote William Nordhaus. Okay, these zero ambition promises come from, it will be promises, it will be, country will do something, but not because they want to do the good for the humanity, that's just because those emissions, reducing those emissions has some co-benefit, which are local. So for example, when you reduce emission of CO2, you also reduce emissions of microparticles, emissions of sulfur dioxide, NOx, and so on. And so because those pollution are local and generate local damages, each country has independently a self-interest to reduce them. Okay, so we will see some effort anyway. Also, reducing emission is energy saving, and there are many reasons why countries may want to reduce the consumption of energy. Also, green R&D, which is a crucial element in fighting climate change, as explained this morning by Philippe. This R&D competition is a competition for rent-seeking. It's a rent-seeking game, and so countries may want to do that. And R&D, green R&D, generate positive externalities. You know, the fact that people do research in green energy generate new knowledge that are useful for many other dimensions and that create values for societies. And of course, big countries like the US and China don't get 1% of the benefits of their abatement. They got much more than that because they are big countries. Okay, so China is a good example of that. Okay, so what's the solution? Well, the solution, which was completely evident from what was said this morning, but it's again maybe useful to remind you that we need a uniform price of carbon to solve the problem. Well, when I say that, it's environmental economics 101. Okay, it's really what I teach in the first course of environmental economics in my university, DC and Columbia. Okay, so I spent half of the course talking about, you know, why price, having a new universal price, either through a tax or a cap and trade, is necessary to get a first best solution. Okay, however, when Jean and I wrote that in June, we didn't expect what we had. So we write a newspaper article in Le Monde, and we got, tons of comments, crazy. No, not a universal price. That's not the good things to do. Well, that's upset me. I mean, that's surprising. You are here, people who have no understanding of the basic rules of and principles of economics. Okay, so we know that we can combine a single price, which is necessary to get the least cost approach to fighting climate change, and differentiated contribution and burden, the sharing of the burden through. So we can, for example, you can have a cap and trade where there will be a single price for the permits, of course, at equilibrium, and in which countries will get more or less free permits through a negotiation process. And so therefore, their contribution will be differentiated, but everybody will face the same price. Why is it desirable that everybody face the same price? Because each molecule of CO2 on this planet, whether it's burned here in Paris by a coal plant or in New York by a driver of a car, generate exactly the same damage in the long run. So we need, in order to force people to internalize this damage, we need them to face the same price, which is equal to the marginal damage. Okay, so that's the standard, again, in environmental economics 101. I'm surprised that it's still in debate. Okay, but maybe we can talk about that later on. Okay, so this single price, it's simply the polluter's pay principle. Okay, and it's orthogonal to the problem of the sharing of the burden of the cost of fighting climate change. And this sharing can be done either through allocation of free permits or through a green climate fund. Okay, well, innovation is important in order to fight the climate change in the long run. There is no, today, there is no mature technology that can, even including the price of carbon, that can fight and compete with gas, for example. So we need to innovate. We need to improve technologies in order that once we include this price of carbon, those new technologies will be able to compete with gas, coal, and fuel. And so in order to do that, we need to provide the right incentive to innovators. And in order to provide the right incentive to innovators, we need to commit on a price path. Okay, what is important for R&D is to know that once we get this innovation, the market value of the innovation will be large enough to compensate for the investment in R&D. And in order to get the price large enough for the innovation, we need to commit on the price of carbon in the distant future. Okay, so we need not only to determine a price of carbon today, but we need to determine a price of carbon for the next 50 years. Of course, the problem is that, as said this morning, there are many uncertainties about the damage, the future abatement costs, because there will be innovation, and therefore we don't know what is the desirable price of carbon in 20 years from now. So we need flexibility. We don't need too much flexibility because sometimes, you know, some countries, once those technologies will be there, some countries may decide to drop any price of carbon, and that we call the hold-up problem. Okay? Once people have done the investment, we don't need the price in carbon anymore because the investment has been done. Okay? Well, so we need to think about that. We need what the important message here is that we need to commit on the price of carbon for many years, not only for the next 5 years. Okay, so two policy instruments. Marty talked a lot about that this morning. So the idea is to negotiate on a price, a universal price, as you understood, or on a quantity, on a cap, allocating these caps among the different countries and allowing the countries to trade those permits on the market that will generate this price, this universal price. And in both systems, what is important is subsidiarity. That is, how different countries will implement this price is open. You could decide to impose this price through cost-benefit analysis of different investment, imposing this price to the public sector when they make public policies and evaluation, or imposing a market for permits. And this, the revenue generated by this tax, the selling of those permits, the auction of this permit will be recycled internally within the country. So there will be no redistribution at the level of the planet. And what is crucial, and what Marty said this morning is really crucial, and I understand that this has not been tried under Kyoto. And the idea is that I will put a price on carbon here in France if you put a price on carbon in China. And that will be the same price. And therefore, when I think about the French position, about what should be, on what price of carbon I should vote, I take into account of the fact that if I raise my price, China will have to raise its price also. Okay? And that's therefore attenuate the free riding problem. I have no time to provide an example of that. Marty almost said everything this morning, so he completely annihilated the necessity for me to present this slide. What is important to remind, so independently upon whether you prefer negotiating on single price, Jean and I, we believe that is, we could also negotiate on a single quantity per capita. So the alternative of what Marty said this morning is, okay, let us negotiate on the emission per capita. So we would give China and the US and Europe a number of permits which is proportional to their population. And we would say, okay, there will be 7 tons of CO2 per capita, or 6, or 5, or 10, and every country will have to face this cap. Okay. Of course, well, and so this is a single negotiation system, single one-dimensional negotiation system that has, I believe, exactly the same characteristic that, than the one proposed by Morty. The difference is, of course, that for the US, it's not a good deal. Of course, the United States prefer to negotiate on a single price, okay? Because we know US people emit twice as much as French people, and for China, that changes every year, so I'm not able to follow that. So you see that, of course, negotiating on price or quantity, different countries, different citizens may have different attitude toward that. And I think in the long run, on an ethical ground, in 20 or 30 years, we will have to have a system where the allowance of emission will be the same for every individual on this planet. Okay. Okay, thank you, Roger. 5 minutes. Okay, there are relative interests of going on price or on negotiation and quantity. As I said this morning in my comments to Marty, I mean, it's completely second order. And today, this question is completely irrelevant. For Paris, we are at the distance of plus infinity to this question of whether we should impose a price, a universal price, through a tax or through a cap and trade. Today, the problem is how to move the dynamics of negotiation towards something that has more a better expectation of commitment and success. So let me switch that. Okay, so what is missing? So one line, one way to do is what Marty proposed, a price negotiation that will alleviate the free riding problem. I like that. I'm excited by this. The alternative is negotiating on uniform emission allowance per capita. Something more important, or as much important as this one, is, as Marty said this morning in his conclusion, we should also impose a system that will imply that we will not start again a Kyoto-like process where people, countries will commit on something and then renege and then not voting the agreement in the Congress and at the end of the day, you know, Kyoto went nowhere. Huh? And even in the EU ETS, the current price of permits on the EU ETS is less than 7 euros per ton of CO2. That just European Union prefer to give up the thing rather than reducing the permit on the market to support the price, just because they knew that they are alone and they face the carbon leakage problem. Okay. So it's normal that when the initial coalition, Kyoto-like, is too small, the incentive to get rid of the system is so large because of this carbon leakage. So we need a system that limits this thing. And the only way to do that, there are two ways. The first way is to impose what Nordos proposed, that is, in the coalition, each country agree not only on the same price, but also on a border tax of something like 5%, any goods and services coming from a country which is not imposing that price will face a 5% border tax. And that is enough to make almost every country part of the deal. And so that's the best way to eliminate what we have observed in the Kyoto system. The alternative is to, and that's what we propose, but that needs to be explored in more detail, to make sure that if a country does not purchase if in the cap and trade system, but we have something similar for a tax, if we go for a cap and trade system, a country that will emit more than the number of permits that it has will see his debt, international debt, public debt increase by that amount at the price of the permit on the market. Okay, so that will provide enough incentive to enter into the process. That's, of course, neither, and these two ideas last year, I mean, I remember when William Nordhaus presented, you remember, Marty, when William Nordhaus presented this idea of border tax in the annual meeting of the American Economic Association last June, I mean, there was an uproar of law in the room. Okay? You had these American people, American economists, 1,000 of them, looking at William Nordhaus proposing a border tax, changing the WTO agreement on this. Okay, it's still true that there will be much resistance to put that kind of thing in place. But if we don't, we will not be able to solve the problem. Okay? It's not easy, but it's crucial. Without a penalty, adaptation becomes the only credible option. So let me finish with my conclusion here, a roadmap. So you understand what's the proposal. It's what most people presenting a paper in this conference believe. We need to put a universal price on carbon, or things are going to be very inefficient, unverifiable, pledge and review, and not credible. Okay, negotiation have started recently with potentially dramatic consequences. That is, we will have to wait for another round in 5 or 10 years from now. A waiting game will continue. Instead of looking for inefficient patches, our cheap pledges agree on short actions and first get an agreement on a good governance, a part of universal carbon price and enforcement strategy, WTO, IMF, an independent, and that's important, I didn't mention that earlier, an independent emission tracking system to measure country emissions. It seems that we now have the technologies to have satellites controlling with the high precision by the year 2020 to 2021. We get enough precision in the emissions per country. Okay, we can even go more precisely to cities, for example. And eventually, and I didn't talk about that, but it's very important, we also, in association to this single price system, we need to negotiate a redistribution, a sharing of the burden of this tax, of this system, in particular in favor of the developing countries, and that's an open question. And that's probably one reason Paris will be difficult to get an agreement on this. Okay, I'm done. Thank you very much.